Well, if you could ask God one question and you knew that he would answer you, what question would you ask? Maybe it would be some sort of big philosophical question. What were you doing before you created the universe? Or why do you allow suffering in the world? Or maybe it would be a more personal question. Why did you allow this or that to happen in my life? Or why don't you heal me? Or why don't you answer this other prayer that I've been praying to you for years? We all have questions, and it's good to raise them. It's good not to ignore them. And we aim to be the kind of church where people can ask questions and we want to engage with them. And that's spiritually good and it's healthy. And as well as discussing questions with each other, we can put our questions to God. And in fact, in the very first session of the Christianity Explored course, it begins by saying, if you could ask God one question, what would it be? So all that is good, but we need to be careful and we need to watch our attitude. It's fine to say to God, look, God, I've got this question I've been struggling with. I don't get it. Please help me understand. That's fine. But it's not okay if that becomes a sort of arrogant challenging of how God is running the universe and how he's running our lives. As if, you know, we could do a better job. Then we've crossed a line. Job had crossed that line. Because of his terrible suffering, he'd started questioning whether God was good and fair and just. And Job had been implying that he could do a better job than God and that God was in the wrong. And this guy Elihu was right to call Job out on this and to challenge him. That was chapters 32 to 37. But Elihu was just the warm-up act. Now in chapter 38, God himself steps in and he speaks up. And this is a big, big moment in the book. So 38 verse 1, if you've got it there. Then the Lord answered Job. Now this is what Job had been longing for, but it's an intimidating encounter. So verse 1, he answered him out of the whirlwind. That is that God comes in a storm, which symbolizes his awesome sovereign power. And he said, verse 2, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Job had spoken words without knowledge. Job had been talking as if he knew better than God, but he didn't. And so God says in verse 3, dress for action like a man. So God's basically telling him to man up and get ready. And I, God says in verse 3, I will question you, and you make it known to me. So Job had been questioning God, but now the tables are turned and God questions Job and he questions us as well. We may have questions that we want to ask God, but he has got questions for us too, and we need to be ready for that. And there's a lot of them. Basically, chapters 38, 39, 40, 41 is all these questions from God to us. Chapters 38, 39 is round one. Then chapters 40, 41 is round two. And we're going to look at just round one this week and next week. And in round one, they're questions which are all about the natural world. So in chapter 38 that we'll look at this week, it's about the non-living natural world. So things like the earth, the sea, the weather, the stars, and so on. And then chapter 39 we'll look at next week is about the living natural world. So wild animals. And the point is that there are spiritual lessons that God has written into nature. That is, through the natural world, God is teaching us spiritual truths. Just as Jesus, in his teaching, he would say, look at the flowers, look at the skies, look at the birds. So the Lord God does here. So the first set of questions you'll see on the outline there are about the earth. So verse 4, God says, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Implied answer, nowhere. Yeah, you weren't even born, but I was there, God is saying. What a first question to put Job in his place. Job had been speaking as if he had understanding and he knew better than God, but how utterly, utterly ridiculous. Little Job had been alive on the planet for a few years, just like we have, but God was there before anything ever existed. Sometimes children argue with their parents, don't they? And they think they know better than their parents do about life and about, you know, what time they should go to bed and all these kind of things. And their parents have to remind them, look, I finished my formal education before you were even born. Okay, maybe I know a little bit more than you. And so God and us, God reminds Job and he reminds us of what he was doing eons before we even existed. He created this whole universe in which we live. So here God pictures his work of creating as a big building project, with God himself as the master architect and builder, and everything was carefully planned and designed and constructed. Precision workmanship. Let's have a look at verse 5. He said, who determined its measurements? Surely you know. A bit of sarcasm there from God. Or who stretched out the line, that is the measuring line, upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? And as it was being built and when it was finished, the heavenly beings rejoiced at how amazingly good the whole thing was. So verse 7. When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. As the Genesis account repeatedly says, God saw that it was good. So the point is that the universe God has made is ordered, it is good. And Job needed reminding of that, as we do, because it is something that we, like him, we easily forget when we are suffering. Take the earth itself. It's a remarkable piece of engineering, isn't it, the earth? You've got the different layers. You've got the inner core of the earth, which is this spinning solid metal ball, three quarters the size of the moon, almost as hot as the surface of the sun, pressures 3 million times greater than at ground level where we live, on this thin crust, which is like the shell of an egg. It's remarkable, just the feat of engineering of the earth. In his book, God's Undertaker, Professor John Lennox speaks of the spectacularly beautiful structure of the universe in which we live. And he talks about the astonishing mathematics that underlie the structure of the universe and the precision fine-tuning of the constants of nature that allow life to exist. When we don't get what's going on in life, when we're tempted to question God about, you know, what are you up to, we need to remember how awesomely good and deeply great he is. That the universe that he has made reflects that. When did you last make something yourself? Maybe you made a meal, or maybe you did a bit of DIY, or perhaps you painted a picture, or you knitted some socks. How did you feel? Did you feel proud of it? Did you do a good job? How does that compare to what God has made? We do well to humble ourselves before him. But we might think, well, yes, the creation is great and it is good, but what about evil in the world? Well, the sea has something to teach us about that. So secondly, the sea. Verse 8. God says, or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? Implied answer, not you, Job, but I did, God is saying. Now, God isn't just saying here, oh, and by the way, I made the sea as well. It's more than that. In the Bible, the sea is a symbol of disorder, chaos, danger, evil. So I put on the sheet there in the footnotes a few references. Isaiah 57:20 says, the wicked are like the tossing sea. Or Luke 21:25, Jesus, he speaks about the distress of nations in perplexity because of the roaring of the sea and the waves. It's clearly a picture of a world in turmoil. Or Revelation 21 verse 1, the vision of the new creation says that the sea will be no more. which doesn't mean there's no more sailing, just means there's no more evil. It's a picture. So if sea symbolizes evil, what is God's point here? Well, look at verse 8. He says, "Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb?" The sea, evil, it has a place in this present world, but within limits. So God has shut it in, he says, with doors. And the picture here is that evil is a bit like a baby to God. So verse 9, he's mentioned the womb in verse 8, and then verse 9, "When I made clouds its garment, and thick darkness its swaddling band," like wrapping up a baby, "and prescribed limits for it, and set bars and doors, and said, thus far shall you come, and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stayed." So he's saying that the sea stops at a certain point. The sea stops at the land. And however fierce it is, the waves break on the shore or they crash against the cliffs, and usually they don't go further than that. And so the point is that God has set limits and bars and doors to evil, which the sea represents. And we saw that, didn't we, in chapters 1 and 2 with the devil, that he couldn't go any further than God allowed. God says, "Thus far shall you come and no further." And so next time you're on the coast, next time you're at the seaside, remember the spiritual lesson that God has written into the sea. That evil is present in this world, just as the sea is in our world. It's not been dried up, but God has set limits to it. It's within his sovereign control. It can go so far, but then no further. We might say, you know, why does God allow evil? Why did God create a world in which he knew that things would go wrong? Why did God not destroy the devil as soon as he rebelled? We don't know, but we do know that God is sovereign. And so God and the devil are not equal and opposing powers. Satan and evil can only go as far as God allows. So God knows what he's doing, and we need to trust him, and we need to take to heart what he teaches us through the sea. And we can look forward to the day when evil will finally be destroyed. And that is something which the dawn teaches us. And that's the third point. Every morning, night gives way to day, and the sun rises again, and a new day dawns. Why? Because God commands it to happen. Everything is sustained by his word. So verse 12, he says, "Have you commanded the morning since your days began, and caused the dawn to know its place?" Implied answer? No, but I have, God is saying. Now, as with the sea, this is symbolic. The Bible says, doesn't it, that the wicked love darkness. And so when the sun rises each day and the darkness flees, it is picturing a spiritual reality. The light coming means there's no place for the wicked anymore. The wicked are like crumbs that are being shaken out of a tablecloth. So verse 13, "that the dawn might take hold of the skirts of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it." Verse 14 then pictures how the sort of 2D landscape turns 3D as the sun rises and light spreads and the features of the landscape stand out. Like it says, it's like clay when it's pressed with a seal, or like folds in a garment. So it says in verse 14, the earth is changed like clay under the seal, and its features stand out like a garment. The Bible elsewhere pictures the second coming of Christ as the dawn of a new day. Revelation 13:12 says, "The night is far gone, and the day is at hand." That's the day of Christ's return. Or Luke 1:78 says, "The sunrise shall visit us from on high." So every sunrise reminds us that the darkness in this world will not last forever. The dawn of every new day tells us that the day is coming when the darkness of evil will be finally destroyed. There's a spiritual lesson God is teaching us every single morning. The final destruction of evil is on its way. It has got no enduring place in God's world. when the new day dawns. Revelation 20:10 says, the devil will be thrown into the lake of fire. Faced with so much evil in the world, and even touching our own lives, we may be tempted to lose heart. We doubt God. We question what God is doing. But he's telling us, look at the sunrise and learn the lesson every new day. Light is coming. The new day will soon dawn. God is in charge. He commands it. Trust him. He knows what he's doing. For our fourth lesson, God takes us back to the sea. But this time, he takes us on a deep dive down into the dark depths of the ocean. So have a look at verse 16. He says, have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Implied answer, you should be getting the point by now. No, but I have, God is saying. The ocean depths are this hidden world to us, aren't they? So light can only travel some 200 meters down in the sea. And below that, below 200 meters, it's completely dark. And yet the average ocean depth is 4 kilometers. The deepest part of the oceans, the Challenger Deep and the Marianas Trench, almost 11 kilometers down. And only in modern times have people, a few people, in high-tech submersibles, they've been able to begin to explore this dark world where these strange creatures live. But although it's hidden to us, it's very familiar to God. And again, there's more going on here. This dark underwater world symbolizes the underworld, as we call it. So the shadowy place of the dead. So look at verse 17. Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? That is probably the expanse under the ocean. Declare if you know all this. The dark spiritual underworld is as foreign to us as the underwater world. Remember, as Hamlet says, he says, death is the undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveller returns. But what is a mystery to us is well known to God. So he knows all about these dark regions. And now in Christ, a human traveller has gone to that foreign country and he's returned victorious. The risen Jesus says in Revelation 1:18, he says, I'm the living one. I died and behold, I'm alive forevermore and I hold the keys of death and Hades. Don't know if you've come across that website, What Three Words, which assigns a three-word name to every 3 square meters in the world. And the idea is that you can pinpoint a location with these three words. So where I sit at my desk in my study at home is Oasis Song Exile, which I quite like. That's the 3 square meters where I sit in my study. Well, God has every square centimeter of the entire universe mapped out, including the ocean depths hidden to us. There's not a square centimeter that is outside his knowledge or outside his control. And that includes the realm of the dead. Death is such a puzzling and a painful part of life in this world. Many godly people die young, while many wicked people live on into old age. And to us, it does not make any sense at all. Many of us here have gone through the pain of bereavement. And all of us here will one day die. But all of this is within God's sovereign control. And so we can trust him, even when we don't understand. And we should humble ourselves before him. The ocean depths teach us that. For our next lesson from the natural world, we head back up above water to think about light and darkness. So verse 19, God asks, where is the way to the dwelling of light? And where is the place of darkness? That you may take it to its territory and that you may discern the paths to its home. Implied answer, you haven't got a clue, Job. But I, God, I do know. From our perspective, the sun rises in the east and it sets in the west. And so light appears to live somewhere over the eastern horizon. and darkness appears to live somewhere over the western horizon. But we don't know the way to their homes. Again, light and darkness are symbolic in the Bible, symbolic of good and evil. It's a big theme in John's Gospel. The light shines in the darkness, or Jesus, the light of the world. We've seen it recently in Ephesians as well. Ephesians 5:8 says, at one time, speaking to Christians, at one time you were darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. The point God is making here is that he is sovereign over light and darkness. Just as in Genesis 1, he said, let there be light, and he separated it from the darkness, creating day and night, so he is sovereign over good and evil. He knows the way to their dwelling places. He takes them home each day. Verse 20, he takes it to its territory. Now we might think, if I were God, interesting way to start a sentence, isn't it? If I were God, I would have just created light and there wouldn't be any darkness in the world at all. I would have created a world without any possibility of evil. Why did God create a world in which he knew evil would come? And God would say to us what he said sarcastically to Job in verse 21. Yeah, you know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. He's making fun of Job, isn't he? Playfully. Job has been alive for just a few brief years, challenging the everlasting God. It's ridiculous to think that we know better than him. Whenever we have a birthday, we think, oh my word, you know, I'm getting so old, I'm ancient. And the Ancient of Days, the everlasting God, laughs. The number of our days is not in fact great. Our short lives are but a breath on a cold day. And a birthday, if you've got one coming up, is a good time to remember that and to humble ourselves before the eternal God, the God who is sovereign over light and darkness. For nature, lesson number 6, God turns to the UK's favourite topic, the weather. The weather's so varied, so changeable. Some of it brings life, some of it brings destruction, but God is in charge of it all. So verse 22, have you entered the storehouses of the snow? Or have you seen the storehouses of the hail? Implied answer, no, but I have, God is saying. Snow and hail, which verse 23, I've reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war. So also stormy wind in verse 24. But then water, which God can use to bring destruction, as snow and hail, God can also send that same element as rain to give life. So verse 25, who has cleft a channel for the torrents of rain? Verse 26, to bring rain on a land where no man is. Verse 27, to satisfy the waste and desolate ground. Job hasn't, but God has. God has created this same element, water, in so many different forms. Notice all the language about God being the father or the mother of these things. So verse 28, has the rain a father, or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb did the ice come forth, and who has given birth to the frost of heaven? Implied answer, God has. He makes them all. And they have such varied effects. So verse 30, the water becomes hard like stone, and the face of the deep is frozen. Whereas, if you skip down to 34 to 38, water is then sent by God as a refreshing, life-giving rain. So verse 34, can you lift up your voice to the clouds, that a flood of waters may cover you? No, Job can't. But God can and he does. God is the one who, in verse 37, can tilt the water skins of the heavens to water the dry, hard ground, in verse 38. Well, life is like the weather. Life is like the weather. It's very changeable. We have good days. We have bad days. We have times when life is great. We have times when it sucks. We have seasons of joy. We have seasons of sorrow. But God is in control of all of it. The weather and life. He's sovereign. Nowadays, we can forecast the weather. Our phones tell us in great detail what it's going to be like this week, but we can't control it. but God does. God is sovereign over all the ups and the downs of our lives and our world, so our lives and our world are in his hands, with all their varied changes and seasons. I wonder how the weather is in your life at the moment. We need to trust him, especially when the weather is bad. When the storm is raging, when the ground is hard and dry, when it's dark and cold, at those times in particular, we need to trust God. And for the final nature lesson, God tells us to look up at the night sky. I wonder what comes to mind when you look at the stars. Verse 31, God says, "Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion?" Implied answer, no. But God's saying, I can. And verse 32 mentions two other constellations. God binds them and looses them, probably in the sense of he fixes them in position, but he also leads them across the night sky. But stars also symbolize spiritual forces in the universe. We had it implied, I think, in verse 7, which mentioned in parallel, verse 7, the stars and the sons of God. The point here is whatever power these spiritual powers have, it is under God's sovereign control. Verse 33. Can you establish their rule on the earth? No, but God can. So whatever influence spiritual powers have on earth is under God's ultimate control. We saw this back in chapter 1, verse 6, when there was that heavenly cabinet meeting of God and the sons of God and Satan. That they cannot influence on earth anything beyond what God allows. And so we may have questions about the influence of evil, but we need to humbly recognize that God is sovereign over all the spiritual powers and forces. And that's a lesson that the stars teach us. The stars are not in charge, God is. Where does all of this leave us? Job was feeling hard done by, wasn't he? Job wanted to question God. Job wanted to put God in the dock. But instead, he found himself in the dock with God questioning him. And the point of God's questions was to put Job in his place and to bring home to Job how absurd it was for him or for us to question God or to imply that we could do a better job than God. God is basically saying to Job, and he's saying to us this morning, look, did you make this amazing universe? Are you in charge of everything? No, so shut up. And stop thinking you could do a better job than me, because you can't. You haven't got a clue. You haven't got a clue how things work. You've no idea what you're talking about, so wind your neck in. That's the kind of gist of what God is saying. And when we get to chapter 40, verse 4, we'll see that Job gets the point and he recognizes, I am of small account. Like Job, we need to humble ourselves before God. And we need to accept that we may not be given answers to some of our questions. Job wasn't given the answers to his questions. So Job wanted to know why he was suffering so terribly. And God didn't actually tell him here what was going on. He didn't tell him the stuff we know as readers from chapters 1 and 2. God didn't tell him that. Instead, God's response was basically, look, I'm the good sovereign creator, so you just got to trust me. Trust me with your life. And he says the same to us today. That we may have lots and lots of unanswered questions. Why am I suffering as I am at the moment? Why this relationship breakdown? Why this chronic health condition? Why this job loss? Why no spouse? Why no children? Why this bereavement? Why this disappointment? We may have so many unanswered questions. And we need to accept that God's answer may be, as it was for Job, simply that he is the good, sovereign, creator God. And it's not for little us to question his goodness or his power, but instead we are to humble ourselves before him and we are to trust him that he does know what he's doing and he does know best.